You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to the new season of Stay Ahead, a podcast from BI Norwegian Business School. This season, we're looking at entrepreneurship and going beyond the startup. I'm your host, Susanna Pinnock. I'm currently doing a PhD in entrepreneurship here at BI, and I've been an entrepreneur myself in the past. So in this series, we've been mainly talking about entrepreneurial firms who might style themselves as purely for-profit ventures. But today we're going to talk about the growth of social enterprises and understand a little bit about how their life and aims differ. So I'm very pleased to be joined by Fredrik Gulofsson and Alessandro Luzzi. Fredrik has described himself as an activist losing faith in aid and is the founder of the Norwegian social enterprise NIBI. Alessandra is an associate professor of strategy and entrepreneurship here at BI. She researches innovation and growth in entrepreneurial organizations, including in hybrid and social enterprises. So welcome to you both. Thank you for coming along this morning.
Thank you.
So Fredrik, can I just start by asking you a little bit about NIBI? As an activist turned founder, can you tell us a little bit about what you're aiming to accomplish and what NIBI does?
Yeah, thank you for inviting me here. So what we are doing, we frame ourselves mainly as a tech company because that's what we are. We have scalability as an important feature. So what we do is that we are accelerating the public sector's transition to a more sustainable future. And that we do by collaborating with municipalities and hospitals and large NGOs, which is a part important part of the welfare mix in Europe. And what we do is that we help them to create way more welfare and care, health and care, with the same resource, with the resources that they already have. And they really have to scale their way of providing care in the future, because we've talked about it for decades now, that we have an aging population and there is a huge increase for care. Actually, it's pretty linear. We need to produce about the double amount of care as we do today with the same amount of resources and the same amount of healthcare personnel. So they really have to change. And if we try, and it's a little bit like the climate crisis, because we've been talking about it for so long time, but then it's really hard with huge municipalities and structures to change. So then it's important to translate kind of what does that transition mean today? And what it actually means is that half of all the welfare tasks that are provided today, we need to do it in a, we need to stop doing it, or we need to do it by technology or by in other ways. So what we do is that we help these municipalities to see, okay, you have lots of needs in healthcare, and then you have lots of underutilized resources as well in the society. Unemployed, immigrants, pensioners, and so on, lots of underutilized resources. And these resources even tend to become a problem because you have loneliness and so on. Mm-hmm. Then you have, on one side, you have too much needs, which in one silo within healthcare. And in the other side, you have too much underutilized resources. It's kind of the long tail of resources in the society that we're not able to utilize with today's structure. So we help municipalities and hospitals and large NGOs to move from silo to collaboration networks, where, for instance, nurses can share tasks directly with qualified personnel from unemployment office, immigration office, pensioners that want to earn extra cash on the side and so on, so that we make their own collaboration networks. So it's a, it's not like a marketplace, but it's more like a software as a service platform for large organizations that can allow collaboration across silos, if
so
that makes sense.
You're matching needs with, it's not just about using existing resources in a smart way through technology. It's about harnessing a whole bunch of different resources as well.
Yeah.
And then using it in a smart way.
Because the big kind of what public sector need to do is to step out of the silos, because the resources are there, but they're not able to reach out to it when they are in a silo structure. So then we can look at this. It's a tech game, but it's a lot about transition, digital transition, culture change, and change management in order to help these municipalities and organizations to accelerate towards a sustainable model.
And there must be quite a lot of mindset change on the part of the municipalities, but also on the part of some of the resource that you mentioned, that they can start doing these things in a way that they didn't envisage before.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we are then, of course, this is not kind of... we are supported by, kind of, this has been in the strategies and national strategies and also EU strategies for about 10 years that we need to collaborate more across silos. So we have created a platform and a methodology to enable their already formulated strategies. That's very, very important.
So it was previously, it was an intention without a mechanism, and you're providing the mechanism to put that intention into play.
Yeah.
Okay, that's just very interesting. So, Alessandra, let me ask you a couple of questions before we move on, of just about social enterprises. We hear a lot about social entrepreneurship. And can you tell us a little bit about how that does or doesn't differ from the way we normally think about entrepreneurship?
Actually, we tend to be used to the idea that companies, whether they are entrepreneurial or corporates, they are mostly focused on financial goals. So they are basically there to maximize the value for their shareholders. And this view became dominant in the past century due to the emergence of this model based on this managerial capitalism, where especially for large enterprises, basically they tended to become managed by hierarchies of salaried managers. And the managers at the same time were there to maximize the value for their shareholders, when we talk about publicly held companies, but at the same time for privately held companies, the same. They are there to maximize the value for their owners. And that was the dominant view until recently, although it's also important to say that that view became dominant, as I said, in the middle of the last century, but it was not always the case, because we can find quotes here and there where different scholars talk about companies having a purpose, like the word purpose, meaning that they have to aim to solve some kind of social issue.
A purpose beyond just profit and maximizing value for shareholders.
But at the same time, this view became dominant also for coinciding with this idea that companies should be using financial tools to evaluate product lines and divisions, and at the same time evaluate the job of the manager. But then over the past decade especially, companies have been more and more encouraged to embrace this kind of, we could call it, and I think that's really the perfect term for today's discussion, dual purpose, meaning that they have to aim for financial goals, but at the same time, in addition to that, they have a very specific social goal or a social mission, like some authors call it. Yeah, so I really like the term dual purpose companies, which is, of course, quite established now in the literature. Mm-hmm. To name these companies that have this, that aim for this positive social impact in addition to serving, obviously, to continuing serving their shareholders or owners.
And so from a point of view of NIBE, Frederick, you obviously recognize this dual purpose, but that it was the social need that gave you the idea for the opportunity. And then can you talk a little bit about the role that profit plays in that? Because a lot of people, I think, would say, oh, these welfare things, they should be paid for by charities, or they should be paid for by taxpayers, or we shouldn't be making profit out of that. What's your take on this, the profit side of the dual purpose?
No, because I think it's interesting to discuss the term dual purpose, because I like single purpose. And I think single purpose is very good for a whole company to have a focus. It's super important. So when one starts with, additional goals and they are not aligned, then that can be a challenge for execution, right? Because one can have great ideas, but it's execution it's all about, and then focus is key. And for us, it has been it started with we didn't kind of add the purpose later, like many companies do that, because now we should have a purpose, and then you should have workshops. What's our purpose actually, and so on, in order to have something in addition. No, it started with seeing that challenge that we need to rethink care, and we need to do it in Norway and Nordics and all over Europe and the Western world. So it started with and it's a possibility to connect people and create way more welfare, go from scarcity to abundance if we think differently, right? So that is kind of the opportunity. And then we started, okay, we want to solve that challenge. And then we started, okay, what's the best vehicle in order to solve that challenge? Should it be an NGO? Or should it be a part of a government project? Should one work in the healthcare ministry or similar like that? But then I've been doing both NGOs, and I've been doing several and participating in several tech startups, commercial ones. And then I found that the best vehicle for scaling something and to scale a problem-solving mechanism is a normal for-profit company. Because when you kind of crack some codes and you're able to provide the growth, then you can print money in a completely different way because you are investable and you can create profit. So then profit is just to get more fuel on the tank in order to solve more social problems for us. But then in order to be investable, then you also need to have profit. And that is the way to scale in a completely different way than you can do as an NGO or you can do as a department within the public sector.
Where you're relying on outsiders to just give you money, whether it's tax money or donations or whatever, whereas with a for-profit goal, you are generating the money that you need yourself to grow and scale. Is that kind of what you're saying in a nutshell?
And then you get autonomous and you get your own, you can have your own drive and set your own agenda in a completely different way compared to being reliable on, different grants and stuff like that. It's not scalable. Yeah.
So when you measure the success of NIBI, how do you do that? Do you measure it purely on profit or do you measure other things as well? Or how does that work? How do you know that you're being successful?
Yeah, I think very kind of super important is to be financially stable and to have so now the last year we have focused a lot on just having being cash flow positive because that's important because we've been investing a lot and then so that is important but the most important is to measure the success of what our customers and partners are able to do with our support through consulting and with the platform, of course. Yeah.
So, Alessandra, can you talk a little bit about this idea of dual-purpose companies maybe having more than one thing to measure? They're not just measuring this shareholder value that you were talking about. They're trying to measure this purpose as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's extremely interesting that Fredrik talks about focusing on one purpose. and I like that because... As he said, at the end of the day, the financial goals are a mean to go through to reach your mission, your purpose. So basically, the idea being that, I open a small parenthesis here because this is probably also due to the fact that, as he mentioned, he started this company having in mind this goal, this purpose of enhancing workforce in the healthcare system and reaching this win-win situation where you have you create value for the organizations that are your customers, but at the same time you reduce the workload for the healthcare people and you work on people's loneliness, so you make them a valuable resource for others. So They started this. This means that you started this company having in mind primarily this purpose, but at the same time you had it clear from start that you wanted to be a for-profit because you wanted to be self-sustainable and you didn't want to rely on donations or such. So I think this idea of the dual purpose company emerged in the, well, I'm talking about the literature now, mostly due to the fact that while in this case we see very clearly an alignment from start, right, between these two goals, there are, we can think of examples of companies where it's not obvious to have this alignment, or at least it's not obvious from start. So maybe, for example, some of these companies may go in, they don't go in tandem with these two goals, but they may have to prioritize one over the other at times, right? And then they have to go back and forth between, okay, now I'm focusing on making, improving my business model so that my purpose is reachable with a financially sustainable process. And then at the same time, and this is what I really like about what you say, the ultimate purpose, obviously, is to scale the company in terms of reaching a higher and higher purpose, a higher and higher social
impact.
Impact. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Sorry, I was missing the word impact.
Yeah. So that's very interesting what you say about your focus may have to shift from maybe not day to day, but regularly, you know, you need to be more focused on one thing or the other thing to try and reach this goal of maximizing both. Is that something that you recognize, or have you managed to be really single focused?
Yeah, I think splitted focus is the entrepreneur's challenge, and to be able to single out what is important in this phase is always a challenge. And I think that again, because I like to think of it more as it's not so much difference between running a social entrepreneur, a company with a social goal or a company with another goal. I think Amazon also focus on, they are highly customer centric, right? They always think what's the best for the customer, and then financial gains comes as a result of that. And the same with if you are really focused on the mission, if that is, or the social mission, if that is close to the business model, then you are able to have that single focus, which is the case in our case, that we work with municipalities that pay us in order to help them to make the transition. So then it's easier. But focus, that's the that I think is in all companies or organizations, maybe the main challenge to find out what to focus on in which phase, because it's different phases and you need to have a different focus. Yeah.
And the municipalities in your case, they're paying you because you solve a problem for them.
Yeah.
Just like any other for-profit business.
Yeah.
You know, that you understand the customer's problem, you understand their goals or whatever, you find a way to help them reach them. That's how you make your profit.
Because
and the way you describe it, it's just absolutely, it's just the source of the opportunity happens to be the fulfilling of a social goal.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no other difference.
Because we kind of analyze the market and say, here it's social problems. Mm-hmm. And then we can help these large organizations to operationalize their own strategies in a scalable way. Yeah.
So Alessandra, in the literature and the studies of these dual purpose companies, is that typical, or are there examples perhaps more often of firms which are, they kind of drift towards being more for profit and they start doing things outside their original purpose in order to feed the profit demand?
Exactly. I think that's, I've been interviewing a few startups that are under this domain, and in the literature, this has a name, and it's they call it mission drift when companies may have at some point a tendency to move towards a business model that is more that leans more towards the paying customers that are not necessarily the stakeholders that they were aiming to address for their social mission when they started. We can think of companies where that's more the case. So as I said before, in some cases it's very clear from start there is this alignment, right? Mm. But maybe a useful way to think about this, Frederick, you can tell me if you agree. There is, we can identify some kind of difference between the paying customer and the ultimate beneficiaries of your purpose, right? Of your of where you want to have an impact. So you talked about organizations being your paying customers, but who would you identify as your broad set of ultimate beneficiaries of your, and that's a nice way to think of how could you measure impact in the social dimension, right?
No, and that is because what we are doing is we are helping these large public sector organizations to and municipalities mainly. We work with more than 50 municipalities and hospitals and organizations, mainly in Norway, but also in Denmark and Germany, and. So in most cases, it's municipalities that is the paying customer. But as this is digital transformation, this is system change. So then it is many stakeholders that we need to think of, and very many kind of personas, if you think of in a product development perspective. So then we have from start talked to labor unions, because this is changing the way nurses work. Mm-hmm. So that's important. And it's important that they don't look at task sharing and offloading nurses as a threat, but as an opportunity, so for them to strengthen their kind of field of work. We have been talking to political parties across the spectrum, because especially municipalities, they are run by politics. So it's important that we don't have red flags for the model there. And I can go on actually for with many different stakeholders. And the ultimate stakeholder is, of course, the patient that needs help.
Exactly.
And the people that can get low threshold entry into work and work practice. That working with stakeholders in this way, that is... that takes more time. It's not just talking to customers, but you need to talk to a broader set. But what we have found, of course, then one spend time on it and talking about focus, it's always also how much should you talk to spend time talking to politicians and labor unions compared to talking to customers. But that has also given us a lot of, it has strengthened our product and solution a lot. And it has given us a lot of awareness, because these are strong stakeholders. So when they understand you and lift you up, then we have got lots of extra attention. So we have, I think we have been invited to more than 200 conferences talking about what we do in public sector conferences, talking about what we do and talking about the transition. And that we wouldn't, like for pure for-profit companies, they are not invited to NRK Lindmo or to 200 public sector conferences to talk about how we should change our system. so that has given us, so almost all our customers are incoming leads. They have seen us on conferences. They have talked to other people or other customers. And then they are coming to us and they want to work with us. And that is because we have a social mission. It's because I think it's so evident for all of them and everyone working in the company that we are there for one single purpose. We really want to make public sector and the welfare state sustainable. And that's obvious for everyone. That's why we attract great people to work with us, and we attract ambitious customers as well. And so it's kind of, yeah, talking to all these stakeholders is also great marketing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's feeding two animals, isn't it? It's marketing and it's learning at the same time.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you also have, like on both sides, you have individuals whose social problems are being solved. So you're talking about this access to work and loneliness problem. That's the provider side, and they're being matched with a need.
Yeah.
So there's the patient side as well, which is, was that your purpose to begin with, or were you more focused just on how can we solve the problem of the patient and the resources that they have access to? And the second thing was kind of, oh, by the way, you know, we're solving this problem.
From the beginning.
Yeah. Oh,
because just look at it as my background is political science, and I've been working then in with humanitarian aid in other cultures and see kind of how they arrange care. And it's from looking at our care system from outside and our public sector from outside, you can see the silo structure really kind of, one can say just if you have too much to do in one silo or in one room of a building, and then you have lots of available people that get lonely and sick of being underutilized in another room. Yeah. And that is kind of very far from the natural state of humans, because if you look at just a village, it's not like one part of the village, nobody does nothing. And in another part of the village, people are super stressed and they need to buy welfare technology in order to keep up with the work, right? So that's just very strange way of organizing society.
You're using technology to kind of reintroduce that sort of community thing that we had when we lived in smaller villages or smaller tribes and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's still in evidence elsewhere. Yeah. We've moved away from. That is so interesting.
And I had, because I've also had a little brother that became more and more ill for many years, and now he doesn't live anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the spark to really dive into care. Because then we were, and many people think that it was so bad care that we needed to rethink the whole care. No, it was not at all, because we were able to get a very good collaboration with the municipality. And because we're a big, strong, resourceful family, we were able to have him living at home until he died. And we had, through that, we got kind of work inclusion, because we got lots of help to our house, funded by the municipality, actually. Mm-hmm. And for instance, fantastic assistant coming from Spain. She was a psychologist, but she didn't speak well enough Norwegian in order to get work. So then she worked with our family and my little brother for about a year, and now she's practicing as a shrink in Norway. So that was kind of work inclusion and a fantastic, I would say, win-win-win situation, because it was a way richer and better life for my brother until the end, yeah. Way better for my whole family, because we could stay at home instead of going back and forth to an institution and so on, and the win for the municipality is way, way cheaper. Yeah. And also for those people contributing, like one veteran from the army and this woman from Spain and so on, work inclusion.
And now we have her able to do what she does best, because she's learned Norwegian and she's worked and that sort of thing. So we've added to the resources and the quality of the resources.
Yeah. So what we wanted to do is to then make that make it possible for more people to have that same experience, basically.
Yes, and so that brings us nicely back to the idea of the whole point of this. Is to scale it and solve as much of this problem as possible. And you started to talk, I think, a little bit about Denmark and Germany and how people are coming to you. So can you tell us a little bit about your growth goals and your how you're going to do the scaling?
Yeah, to begin with, we had... So we started actually getting customers before we had a single line of code. So we started just with a pitch deck, and we got the first municipalities, I think 5 or 6 municipalities, prepaying a couple of $100K in order to be R&D partners. And that was very important to validate the concept.
So sorry for the interruption. So how did you manage to get them involved without a clear tech available at that point?
Then we were. That is a great thing, actually, working with the public sector, because you always have to understand the market you should operate in, right? And then you have to spend time on market analysis and so on. But we could look at all the strategies that were already there and publicized, and all the research around it. So the whole kind of need and the problem was very well defined, and as well also the direction they wanted to go in. They wanted to go in the direction of collaborating more, including more people into care and so on. So then, and this was at the time where sharing economy was the new thing. It's about 2016. So one had to kind of explain what is peer-to-peer and platforms and so on. But then they bought into that vision and into that opportunity. And then we got some really nice committed R&D partners from start, because we could never start with a kind of system change platform and mission without strong partners with us from the start. So about lean startup, we can think, yeah, I should make the first minimum viable product and then start selling it. Way better is those times you can just make a pitch deck.
And then that is the minimum viable product, right?
Because so, for us, the minimum viable product is really big, because this is so we needed to get buy-in before we could make that, because this is sensitive information. It's lots of complexity, how to make different juridical landscapes, how to make healthcare work with unemployment office, NAV in Norway, you know, that is a lot of complexity, both juridically and technically and so on. And it's really hard also to make that complexity simple, because it has to be super easy to use for nurses and for unemployed and so on. So that has been a huge product challenge.
Yeah.
So that's why we needed to really test this and work with this very, very close with the customers.
So yeah, I understand what you're saying, but then my question is, how did you manage to get their trust right from the beginning without being able to show a full product, a full tech?
Yeah. I spent time on created this pitch deck talked to many people, stakeholders about it, even including labor unions and political parties and juridical experts and so on. So it was quite solid, thought through concept. And of course, it helped a lot that both me and my fellow founder had a serial entrepreneur background. That helped a lot. But it's also super important to think ambitious enough from the start, because it's like building a house with four walls at the same time. And if one are ambitious enough, then one get also great partners. So we attracted great partners, like both consulting companies and other partners that were in our kind of portfolio. And then once we got one or two municipalities joining, then more wanted to join. And that is kind of the, and then we got investors, and then we kind of had the first four walls of the building, because that, I think, is so many. It's almost equally as hard to build something small as building something larger. But you need to kind of decide the ambition level, and then you will get the partners and the team and the company and the investors that are kind of have a buy-in to that vision. And this vision was a big one. Without the first paying customers, we wouldn't have got the rest. Yeah.
Okay. So how did you express the scale of this ambition to them?
This is actually about, this is not about kind of, are we able to be a little bit more efficient in the future? Are we able to save something? This is about either we are able to turn this demographic change and shift, which is considered as a care crisis, either we are able to turn that into a system change. That means that we can have better care in the future, because we move from silos and scarcity into collaboration networks and abundance. So either we can change, move it into something better, or we will not be able to have welfare states even close to the level that we have now, 10 years from now.
So it was presenting them with a completely new conceptual way of solving a problem, not just another 5% or another 10%, or maybe we just catch up a little bit here.
Yeah.
We save 3% time of a nurse here, but really a fundamental shift in how we address the care needs.
Yeah.
And whether you do that on a small municipality basis or a national basis, the thing is still quite radical.
Yeah.
Radically.
Yeah, totally.
Bigger.
So yeah. It's a new way. It's moving from scarcity to abundance, because the resources are there.
So it looks like a big scale thing, no matter who you're talking to, is the point I'm trying to make. It's
not
saying, we want to do this across the whole of Europe by 2030. It's just, if we can do this in this municipality, we solve your problem.
Yeah.
And then we can do it in the next one.
And that, because this was a long route to your question about scaling. Mm-hmm. Because to begin with, we had prepaying customers, and we had the first pilots out in the quite large MVP then after 2 to 3 years that we start see, okay, now we have proven totally new ways of collaborating across silos, never done before. And then we had lots of attention and lots of incoming leads, and we were invited to the government's care conferences and stuff like that. And then we had massive incoming leads. And then we thought, at that time, and that was, looking back, a big mistake, but at that time we had no acquisition cost. You know, people just called us and sent videos of us explaining the concept and said, look at this, like flipped classroom sales, you know. Mm-hmm. So look at this, and if it's interesting, then we'll come and meet you and we'll discuss how we do it. And we had at that time we thought, okay, the market really needs this, and we need to just sell it as fast and land grab as fast as we can. And then we sold it really cheap in first because we had no acquisition cost. So, and we sold it cheap in order to avoid tender regulations, all this just in order to land grab fast. And we had lots of indications from the market that this was the way to go, actually. But then we found after like the huge ocean between what the municipalities say that they want to do and what they actually do, because they bought this and were super enthusiastic, and it was buy-in from the whole CEO group and so on. But then, and then we created great pilots with them and so on, but then no scaling plan. Mm-hmm. It became pilots and nice stories, but it didn't change the way they were working, as they were saying. So that is why we now have changed our strategy. We are now growing way more. We are working way deeper with fewer municipalities. So we have added way more consulting and change management and so on, because we're acknowledging that this is a system change, and they need help, a lot of help, in order to make that transition. At least the first 10 to 20 municipalities, so that we can get even better examples of how it can be scaled and done.
That's so interesting, because I'm doing some research in healthcare as well, in entrepreneurial healthcare firms, and they all kind of, scaling is just so hard.
Yeah.
It is just so difficult. There's so many stakeholders, there's so many different people you've got to convince. They've all got a different agenda. Some want to save, some want to do this, some want to do that. And it's a very, very tough problem in healthcare, in particular, to scale, I think.
Yeah, and then scale, one can talk about, it's so many dimensions. Like, so what I like mainly focus on is then to scale within one customer, move from basically pilot till scale. And then so often one overlook kind of the transition phase from a successful pilot into established new way of working. And in that transition phase, one need to spend a lot of resources, especially then the municipality or the organization wanting to do the scale. They need to spend way more on the scaling rather than the piloting. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is that's a challenge in public sector. We say in Norwegian that we have more pilots in public sector than Norwegian and SAS combined, you know. It's lots of pilots, and people love being innovative and so on. But what they should be good at is to scale and implement stuff that works, not just reinvent the wheel all the time. And that's also a challenge, I think, to academia. Because if you look at innovation as a funnel, then all the new stuff, that's where it's easy to get funding and grants and so on.
Yeah.
But if you have a purpose to make sustainable healthcare, then you need to scale stuff, because you're not helping people. And that comes again to, it's easy to get lots of consulting projects for totally new stuff, but you're not helping the stakeholder before it is scaled and the new way to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. And also in scaling, I just need to say it, one, it's also easier to talk about what you should do But it becomes hard for an organization when you should talk about what you should not do. Because if you start with something new, you really should stop doing something as well. Like one metaphor on it is, I talked to 20 years ago, hopefully, they started with email at schools so that the principal could send email to their staff instead of sending paper, right? Mm-hmm. And then the principal just said, yeah, okay, I'll start sending emails, but I'll put the paper in the mailbox as well, because it's, after all, important that they get the information, right? And then that is not, then you have the digitalization means that you have two tasks, you know? And then it's extra work, and that is the perception very often, that it's extra work. But it doesn't kind of, it's not transition until you take away the mailbox. That is the important, and that is where the discussion comes, and that is what one needs to do in order to have system change. If you want more of something, you need to identify what you should stop doing.
So I think this really goes back to what we said before, right? Because your main goal is, of course, to have your paying customers and to sell them your product. But at the same time, as a dual purpose company or as a social enterprise or whatever you want to call it, your goal is to change the system.
Yeah.
So you're really learning together with them.
Yeah.
How to improve on your product and how to address your ultimate objective, which is to really change the system and make it more effective and more. So how did you? We're telling a story that is that seems very bright and successful. But how did you actually go through this process? When was the moment when you realized that you were a successful company and that you actually were achieving your objectives, both financially and in terms of your main purpose?
I would say we're not there yet.
Okay.
Because this is working with public sector, talking about that ocean from all the applause and how enthusiastic all our customers are about this and so on, how it maps with their current strategies and so on, into kind of them scaling. It's that is really a marathon. We had the indications in, I think, 2018 and 2019 that this would just spread, as I talked about, super quick. But then we have realized it's a way more pixels to kind of fill in. It's a bigger challenge, so that's still, we are learning a lot and cracking the codes how to do it, but we do it together with our committed customers. So we are on the right path, and we hope that we will be able to make that change in the Nordics and in Europe, because we have to within 2030. If we're not able to turn this challenge into an opportunity, then we won't have even close to the welfare that we have today. It will be like UK and way worse, where you have an NHS in crisis, and that's just the beginning. We're just So it's, we need to fix this. Yeah.
Yeah. So would it be correct to say that your companies are experimenting and pivoting and, you know, going through change in all different ways, but would it be correct to say that it's a continuous learning process where you have this kind of final goal that you want to achieve, and you say, it's interesting to say, you feel like you're far from there yet, and then you are kind of constantly adapting and constantly, and what is that you are adapting? Is it your platform? Is it your technology? Is it, in what way do you feel like you're adapting?
To begin with, it was, as we talked about, the big MVP. So it was important to get something that was according to the requirements and so on. Now we have something that works, and we have seen it scale, and it scaled in some municipalities and with some NGOs in a great way. So it's not a technical challenge at the moment now. It is it is way more kind of what we could say, everything around it, helping municipalities with communication so that it's clarity in the transition that they need to make, helping them with real buy-in and ensuring real buy-in, and helping them with incentives, because that's an important thing. Very often in innovation also, you get funding to develop the new stuff and to run the pilots and so on, but you need to ensure that the incentive structure in such systems change is aligned with a new way of working. Because if it's not clear what's in it for me for each silo in order to collaborate, they won't collaborate. They can do it in small scale, but it won't be the new way of working. We had like one example of that was during COVID, and one found out that you could do video sessions with your doctor, right? About time, but still, one found out. But then to begin with, it was not possible for a doctor to be paid for doing video consultations. But then very quickly, you got those incentives, and then it really happened, right? So that is super important. You have lots of innovation, but if the kind of structure or the KPIs of the different managers are not aligned with the new way of working, then it won't happen. So we work with now both communication and clarity, and stating the problem in an addressable way for what does it mean today, communication and clarity, and buy-in. We help the healthcare managers and so on to get buy-in from the politicians and so on, because this is huge questions actually. And then we work with incentives, and incentives is key.
This reminds me about a discussion that we kind of overlooked about complexity, right? Mm. Of this is also very peculiar. Susanna, you were asking me before what's special about social enterprises. Well, definitely one thing that is special about them is that they tend to focus on purpose and goals that are highly characterized by a very high degree of complexity, right? Mm. Because there are so many different stakeholders involved, and you really need to work on changing the mindset of the users and of your own customers. Yep. That need you not only have to focus on developing what you're selling them, but also creating the right incentives for the people to adopt it. And so it's really a challenging task that that goes in all directions.
Yeah. But and this would have been just like a way too ambitious project if it was not for or without very committed partners and customers. So we have we work with tech, and we work with methodology, help them to implement ways in as easy way as possible, and we help them with strategy. So that we have kind of grown our service portfolio. But also we work a lot with learning and exchange of experience exchange. So we have like a couple of, 2 months ago now, we had a full day with 20 different municipalities and hospitals and representatives from many of our customers, spending a full day sharing experiences and going from pilot to scaling, because that is kind of the challenge that most of them are facing with Nibi, but with everything that they do. Yeah, so that is we're completely relying on really committed customers, of course.
Mm. And I think that brings us back to what you were saying earlier on, which is that you have, as a company, you have to make some profit to fuel this scaling, because if there's no funds available beyond kind of R&D and early innovation stages, then the only thing that's going to pay for your investment of time and resource to help the municipalities to scale is going to be the profit that you generate. It's got to be generated from within that relationship.
Yeah, so that's why it's important to be able to charge for the time we spend on developing this with them. That's super important. And we weren't good enough on doing that earlier, because we thought, oh, this will scale as crazy, so we can just live only on license. But then we said, no, we need to charge that, and it's that is consulting. So it's a very, very, very straightforward business model. And then it's consulting as a beachhead in order to enable them to scale their strategies on a software as a service platform.
Mm. But then they also have to understand that they have to find some funds to pay you for the consulting that's going to allow them to unlock the benefits. And that's a different sale again, right?
Isn't it? So that is also one. To begin with, many then municipalities approached us and they were so enthusiastic about the Nyby vision and so on, and they created Nyby as a separate project. And then it becomes harder because then you all the time have to defend exactly that project, and that project competes with, in most cases in the municipality, 30 different other strategic projects that they are struggling with. So we now way more look at, okay, what's the main top two or three projects that you are doing related to the transition to a sustainable future? And then some don't have particular ones, and then we really want to work with those that are ambitious on that already. So one example is Lillestrøm municipality. They have allocated 120 million NOK for the next 3 years in order to do what they call a technological transition. And then we are three strategic partners into that program, which is Atea and something called Sensio, and then us at the Nyby. And also with OsloMet as researchers on that. And then we have already a project and funds is already allocated. Mm-hmm. And then we can work with them and they have that political buy-in and so on. And that is a way to go more and more. So we work with several of those we've worked with for a long time now is to find, okay, what bigger project can we connect this to? So that, and then we're not having a new concept, but they already have strategies. And then how can we together accelerate those and operationalize and accelerate those strategies they already have? So that we see also more kind of in the consulting part, we can be way more customizable for using kind of the words and so on that they already have anchored with their politicians and so on.
I know we're going to come to an end in a few minutes, but I just want to say that it's so interesting to me that when I ask you about scaling for Nyby, your answer is about helping customers scale it.
I completely agree.
You talk vaguely about, we need to solve this problem in Western Europe, but your focus is always on the municipality, on the user, right? It's not, I want Nyby to be all over Sweden within a year or something. It's like, no, we need to help these guys scale and really make that change.
You actually said you have to reduce the number of customers at some point, right?
Yeah.
To make sure that you can really help them scale.
That's a very interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and that is just because we rather want to work with those that are really committed, because that's also an acknowledgement. It's always one easily to talk about when is the market mature, right? And then we thought the market was more mature than it is, than it was. And then it's a question, is it mature now or is it mature now? But what we see now is that some municipalities and some hospitals, they are mature because they have that plan and they have a plan with clarity and so on. And then we work with them. And through working with them, we show examples of scalable ways of solving this. And that is also a very important part of accelerating the transition, because if more competitors pop up or something, that's also okay when we look at the mission, because we need everything we can in order to reach the purpose within 2030.
Yeah, and having a few customers who really manage to do it, that will help the rest to mature more quickly, right? It'll be fantastic reference cases for other health systems or social care systems.
That's a fantastic thing with the public sector, actually, because it's lots of challenges with them. It's the tender system, it's slow, it's a lot of kind of banging the head against the wall, but they share no problem with each other, and they have no secrets, because they're not competing, and they're very similar. So it's a lot of the same stuff we can resell again and again and again. Yeah. Even we see Sweden and Denmark and Germany. Yeah, Germany is a little bit different, but it's very much the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's much easier in your view to kind of have this contagious effect where other entities will recognize the value of your innovation, looking at how the others have scaled.
Yeah.
Actually, that's why focusing on them scaling is key, right?
Yeah, right.
That's very interesting. Yeah,
and we have seen even on early pilot stage with just some small proofs, they are super. They come visiting each other and they are selling our concept and so on because they see that this is the way to go. Yeah.
So I want to finish by thanking both my guests, Alessandro Lizzi and Frederik Olofsson, very much for a fantastically interesting conversation.
Thank you.
And I wish you all the best in the future. It's just absolutely fantastic to hear your story. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.